On this edition of the Scott Radley Show podcast, we are talking about sex offenders within Hamilton. A new report in The Spectator is talking about the number of them that are here and where they are living in the city. We'll be discussing that one. We're going to talk about the an Antarctic expedition that has made a remarkable discovery in the last few days. And, of course, we'll talk about the fact that baseball now has a new deal and baseball will once again be on the field as opposed to arguing in the boardroom. Stick around.
Today on the Scott Radley Show on 900 CHML.
I don't spend a lot of time thinking about sex offenders. I don't know why I would, quite honestly. Don't know why you would, quite honestly. But then someone looks into it. Someone puts a Freedom of Information request in and gets some information about where they are and are they in this city and how many are in this city. And you know what? All of a sudden, you start to think about it and you start to wonder. Well, the person who put in that Freedom of Information request was Katrina Clark from the Hamilton Spectator. She's got a piece up at thespec.com right now. Here's the headline. Hamilton has a high concentration of sex offenders. Oh, goody. I added the oh, goody. That was not in the headline. What does that mean for the community is the rest of the headline. Katrina joins us now. Katrina, thanks for doing this today.
Thanks for having me, Scott.
So you find out when you put in this Freedom of Information request that we have more than 500 registered sex offenders living in Hamilton. The headline says that's a high number. Is that a lot? Is that way a lot? Or is that a little bit more than a lot? I have no idea what the context is for sex offender living arrangements in Ontario. What do we know?
So, I mean, it absolutely depends on context here. So our rate is higher in Hamilton than the provincial rate. And I'm trying to go through my story to pull up the exact stats here. But so the provincial rate is about 96 sex offenders per 100,000 people. And Hamilton's rate is about 119 per 100,000 people. So in the larger scheme of things, our numbers, I mean, 500 people in a population of, you know, how many do we have now? Over 600,000. It's not extremely high. It's just we do have a higher rate than the province.
And the part of this, and you've got a cool map on the story, so people can go to thespec.com and look at this and pull up their neighborhood and find out, which is always helpful. And again, the what you just said, we don't have an extraordinarily high number relative on average. But there are some neighborhoods in the city that do, if it was 90-something per 100,000, you said, I think. I mean, the neighborhood with L8N, which is right down by the 403 in Main Street, I believe. I mean, 325 per 100,000. I mean, four times, I guess, the average. I mean, there are hotbeds in the city or hot spots, I guess.
Yeah, there are certainly spots where there are higher concentrations. And the story tries to get at why. It's difficult to understand why, but part of what could be contributing to higher rates could be things like greater supports for sex offenders in that area, halfway houses, addresses of jail, people who are still incarcerated. Those addresses are included on the registry as well. So it's a number of different factors, and the article is absolutely not meant to cause alarm. It's just to provide information, and it's a very long story. I hope people read the whole thing, but there's a lot of good context in there for understanding, you know, what's going on in the city.
So, I mean, when you talk about the halfway houses and the supports, that's a positive thing, ultimately. I mean, we don't want, I know people are going to be freaked out by having registered sex offenders in their neighborhood, but if it is for a positive reason, that, you know, am I reading this right? That could be a positive thing that you would have higher numbers in certain areas of town because they're getting help.
Yeah, certainly that could be one way of interpreting it. I spoke with an individual who runs an organization that helps transition registered sex offenders back into communities. And what he was saying is, you know, it's important not to, you know, stigmatize these individuals because that can actually contribute to reoffending and for people to go underground. And, you know, it's people are going to have to, you know, people don't stay in jail forever. They don't stay in prison forever. Eventually they're going to be released into the community. So if they're released with supports, that's extremely important, and it can lower, you know, rates of recidivism as well.
Do you have any idea, when you were talking to people, any idea how many people interpret it that way, though, to say, you know what, like, we shouldn't be freaking out about this. This is going to be, you know, good that we're helping them. And how many people are on the other side saying, yeah, I don't want 324 sex offenders per 100,000 in my neighborhood. What's going on?
Yeah, I totally get the NIMBY, the not in my backyard. And, you know, I think it's understandable that people wouldn't necessarily want people who've committed horrible offenses living in their community. And I spoke with, you know, survivors of an individual who is on the sex offender registry, and he has, you know, breached his probation conditions a few times. And these people who are survivors, they live in fear that he will harm them again. They live in fear that he will harm someone else. So absolutely, that's a valid way of looking at this.
Are you, now you did the FOI to find this out. In that information, what were you able to get? Like, what's included in information about sex offenders? Do you know where the addresses are? Do you know who the people are? Do you know what they did? Or is it very broad?
So I actually was lucky with this one, and I didn't have to file an FOI, but before me had filed an FOI. This was about 14 years ago or so, and that led the way to this information being made publicly available. So basically, all I had to do was go to the Ministry of the Solicitor General and ask, you know, the last time this information had been asked for, it was by Global News, I think in 2008. They had to fight for this for a long time. The case went all the way to the Supreme Court, and the province ended up having to hand over the information to them. So what I ended up getting, and what Global had gotten back in the day, was a list of the FSAs. So that's a forward sortation area. That's the first three characters of your postal code, and then the number of offenders listed as having an address in that region. So that is all I got. And from there, myself and the team at the SPEC did a lot of analysis to try and understand what all of this meant, and came out with this story.
So what if let's say you were a victim, or let's say you have been a victim of sexual abuse or whatever at some point, are you able to do beyond? Do you know if you're able to go beyond what you were able to do? Could you find out if someone's living on your street, for example?
My understanding, well, I mean, in rare cases, you know, police will put out releases if, say, a high-risk offender is being released into a community. They're not necessarily going to say where that individual is living. They're just saying this person is being released and they want the public to be aware. In terms of individuals who are survivors, I'm not sure. My understanding is that, you know, people, when they've been released into the community, they have a right to privacy just like anyone else. And, you know, their address isn't going to be shared with people who it doesn't need to be shared with.
It is a fascinating story. It is a long story. I would encourage people, though, to go and give it a read, because it's very interesting. And whether you are the listener, whether you are of the opinion that the, you know, sex offenders should be made public and we should know every step they take, or whether you believe we should step back and let them reintegrate into society and try and rehabilitate and not do it again, it's well worth a read. Katrina Clark, thanks for the time today. Really appreciate it.
Thanks for having me.
Just as a quick breakdown of the top, she's got here in her story, the top 12 neighborhoods per 100,000 population. So if you're in Hamilton, listen up. See if your neighborhood is in this one. Number one, L8N, which is in like Corktown, Stinson area. Number two, so I had the L8N in the wrong place. It was Corktown, Stinson, not down at the 403 and Main Street, which I thought it was. So L8N, Corktown, Stinson, number one. L8L, which is downtown, number two. L8M, Gage Park and Stipley, which would be number three. L8P, Kirkendall, number four. L8H, East Hamilton, five. Then Downtown Central, L8R, L8K, Red Hill, L8S, Westdale, Ainslie Wood, L9A, Central Mountain, and L8V and East Mountain. They're your top 10. And again, what does that mean? Does it mean that your neighborhood is crawling with sex offenders? No, it doesn't mean that. it doesn't mean that. For example, the L8R1, the downtown central, there were 18 registered sex offenders in the entire downtown. So it doesn't mean that it is just they are everywhere. And, you know, I don't think we would interpret it that way. I don't think. But it's a fascinating story. This is one of the most difficult and challenging things for the justice system and the prison system and the rehabilitation system to try and figure out. And I'm not an expert. I don't know what the answer is to this, but go read it. It's a very good story. And a fascinating story that will affect you. Well, your neighborhood will be in there if you are from Hamilton. Hamilton has a high concentration of sex offenders. What does that mean for the community? It's by Katrina Clark. It's at thespec.com.
You're listening to the Scott Radley Show podcast on 900 CHML.
Fascinating story that I noticed yesterday. You probably noticed it yesterday as well, that there had been this discovery in Antarctica of a famous ship that had been missing for a century. And not just that Ernest Shackleton's ship had been found, but the condition that it was found in was absolutely remarkable. I don't know that we can describe it as pristine, but it's pretty darn close to that. Dr. Ann Coates is a senior lecturer from the University of Portsmouth's School of Civil Engineering and Surveying. She is a marine historian. She joins us now. Dr. Coates, thank you for the time today.
You're welcome. Thank you for inviting me.
When you saw this, were you surprised at the state of this ship? Because it, as I say, for 100 years underwater, it looked pretty darn amazing.
Absolutely. I'm not an archaeologist, so I'm not used to seeing ships underwater. But most ships, when they've been underwater for a couple of years, are showing evidence of attack by marine organisms and growths. So it is amazing. It is absolutely amazing to see it in such perfect condition. You know, that the woodwork is, yeah. You know, I mean, it was a newer ship anyway, because it's only been built a couple of years before Shackleton took it to the Antarctic. So it's just astounding that the waters of the Antarctic are so good at preserving wood.
To the point where when they showed photos of the stern of the ship, the name was perfectly visible as if it was built yesterday. I mean, it was amazing.
I know. Yes. It's uncanny, but it's the richness of shipwrecks to amaze us and to take us into a different world. You know, people who are nowhere near the sea can feel that excitement and that magic of that artifact that's been there for over 100 years. And it's something positive, you know, it's a really exciting experience.
Let's talk about that for a moment, because I love history. I was familiar with the name Ernest Shackleton, and I was vaguely familiar with the story. Of course, now that this has been found, and I would encourage everyone to go read it, it's a remarkable, remarkable story, where this ship and its involvement and everything else. But I have to believe that what you just talked about, when you find an artifact, when you find something like this, there's going to be millions of people rushing off to try and find out the story behind this. This sort of brings that history right back to life.
Yes, it really, we can engage with it in a way that it would never occur to us before, because we've seen it. It's taken into that experience. And this is what shipwrecks can do. They can give us lives and stories and knowledge, you know, that's interesting knowledge, scientific knowledge. So it really opens our minds to what, you know, a ship is like of that era and what the people were like who took it there, because it was an amazing story of Shackleton's attempt to cross Antarctica, and not many people know about it.
No, and you're right, it is amazing, and I mean, in very much in brief, and please, you correct me where I get it wrong here, but he was trying to be, well, first of all, he wanted to be the first, I understand, to explore Antarctica. He didn't get that. Then he said, I'm going to walk across or traverse Antarctica, And then his ship got stuck in the ice for months, correct? I mean, it was months they were sort of stuck there, mm-hmm. and then sank, and they had to escape, and they all made it back, right? His entire crew survived.
Well, not his entire crew. Some of them died, but want of Shackleton's efforts. I mean, it sort of opens up this world of why do these explorers go to such extreme and inhospitable environments? You know, what were they seeking? Was it personal self-fulfillment? Was it nationalistic? You know, was it idealistic? To try and reach parts of the world that nobody else had reached. So Shackleton was, he'd been disappointed twice by not reaching the South Pole. Other people beat him to it. So he set himself this other target that nobody else had achieved. So it was quite an egotistical expedition, but it obviously, it satisfied national aspirations because the king was in favour of it, the Admiralty were in favour of it. It was to do with the empire still. The empire was still an important institution around the world. So this story tells us so much about society at the time and, you know, what Shackleton was like. But really the most important part of the story wasn't the fact that he didn't cross Antarctica, but that he managed to row 800 miles.
Yes.
To get a ship to come back and rescue the others because there weren't enough spaces on their little rowboats. That's all they had, the little 20-foot boats.
It is an amazing, amazing story. We're short on time, but just the fact that this sat underwater for, as I say, almost a century. I believe the day it was found was the 100th anniversary of his funeral, remarkably enough. The time frame, the fact that this was missing for so long, that has to add to the mystery and add to the story and add to all the stuff. If this had been found 2 years later, we probably don't, it doesn't build the legend, I guess is what I'm saying, that this does by being lost for so long.
Yeah. But it's also testament to the endurance of the archaeologists, mm-hmm. that they knew it was there somewhere. They had to proceed sort of diligently and scientifically to quarter the ocean bed in the area that they knew it would be until they found it. And also the scientific capabilities of their rove machine that could bring back all these images. So yeah. It's in a sense that you needed to have the technological capability to have a machine that could go down 3,000 feet and bring back such amazing pictures.
And hard to find, of course, because this ship was made of wood. If it was metal, it probably would have been easier to find by a mile. But I mean, it was it much more difficult when it doesn't have the metal to bounce back.
True. Yeah. Absolutely.
It is a remarkable story, and I would encourage people, if you don't know the Ernest Shackleton story, and admittedly, my knowledge of it was less than it is today after hearing about this and learning about it, it is a great story to go and look up, and he is now cited as one of the great leaders of all time for how he was able to turn this series of disasters into something that was, well, maybe not successful, but survival. And that was amazing. Dr. Ann Coates from the University of Portsmouth, really appreciate the time today. Thank you for doing this.
Thank you.
You're listening to the Scott Radley Show podcast on 900 CHML.
Let me bring in our friend Steve Foxcroft. He is a guy who is an official in various sports. He is a commentator of various sports, and we love having him on the show. Steve, thanks for doing this tonight.
Scott, good to be with you.
So baseball players and owners came to an agreement today. There will be baseball. Spring training is going to begin on March the 13th. Voluntary report date 2 days before then, March 11th. So we're talking about tomorrow. Players can show up tomorrow. Sunday, things get rolling for real with spring training. There's going to be a full season. All those canceled games are now back on the slate. There's a bunch of stuff that happened, but Steve, here is the thing that I hate about this, and it's part of the settlement. The owners wanted it. 12 of the 30 teams in baseball are now going to reach the playoffs. baseball was always special because it was really hard to get into the playoffs. And now we're just chipping away at that so that even, well, great teams will get in, really good teams will get in, and now just good teams will get in. I hate that.
That's something that, yeah, baseball was always unique. And remember, too, the 100, like the games that they play, and to not eliminate as many teams because of it, it makes the regular season almost meaningless, or so many meaningless games that happen. Now, some will argue that a lot of the teams were out of it by the time July 1st rolled around, but that encouraged them to get better, right? Whether it's through free agency or the draft or what have you, but it takes away a little bit. It waters down the playoffs. And, you know, in most sports too, when the playoffs roll along, the higher seeds almost always get through, right? So it makes for some, like, playoff games that aren't even, there's no entertainment value to them.
Baseball is not designed to have a playoff of a one-game elimination or even a best 2 out of 3. The way baseball is built is for your pitching staff to, for the depth and for all that kind of stuff. There's going to have to be now, because they're not going to play till January. They're going to have to start whittling away at this, and you're going to have the really good teams that are built for the long haul, built for the regular season, built to go the distance, have one bad game, and they're going to be done in an elimination game. And I find that it worked so much better before, when you had the American League East and American League West champion, National League East, National League West. Now we're going back a ways here, and they played a best 4-7, and then the winner of that played in the World Series. It was equal. It was fair. There wasn't a fluke element of it. I hate watering it all down so much. I hate that. I hate it.
And you know, back to the COVID season where the Jays kind of snuck in as the extra team, and that was when they kind of expanded a little bit, but it was due to COVID. It wasn't for this reason. But really, as much as I was excited that the Jays got in the playoffs, they didn't stand a chance in that series. Like, they got walloped. They had no chance. So that's what's going to happen too. These higher seeds, they're going to get by. Or worst case, like you said, if it's a one gamer and if a higher seed is involved, if they don't have like the play-in situation, a hot pitcher could get rid of a team with 105 wins or something like that, you know? So it's not good at any point, in my mind anyway. This is just giving in, and it's to me about greed and television money and all that kind of stuff, and I don't like that. Like,
oh, of course it is. That's exactly why the owners want it. They want more playoffs because that's where your big, big, big money is.
It's not good. And, you know, it's already, first of all, in most sports, too, you factor in time zones, too. So for us growing up in the Eastern time zones when the games are starting, when you get to the finals in any sport, but we're sticking with baseball here, they're like 9 o'clock starts, and they're minimum. Have you ever seen a playoff game? They're minimum 4 hours. Like, it's way too long.
A lot of them are because it's, you know, every pitch matters, which is true and stuff. But yeah, they do tend to drag. All right. That's baseball. Baseball is back. The good news is baseball is back. At least we'll have baseball. We're not going to be just talking about labor issues for the next 3 months, which is like, that's akin to, that's as much fun as Mr. Givarji's had watching me do physics back in high school. Let's go to this next one, because I'm trying really hard to find an explanation. We know Alex Ovechkin, we've talked about this on the show. Alex Ovechkin has a track record where he has been chummy with Vladimir Putin. He actually helped him with an election thing some time ago. But you know what? Look, it's you can have a friend, you can have a leader that does something that you did not expect or don't support, and you can distance yourself. And yet, if you go on Alex Ovechkin's Instagram page right now, his Instagram profile photo is still a photo of him and Putin together. And I'm just looking at this going, who is giving this guy advice? Like, people have said, yeah, but he can't do anything because his family is in Russia. And if Ovechkin says anything outrageous and strongly against Putin, his family could be in danger. I'll grant you that one. I'll give you that one. But leaving up your Instagram picture of you and him together, you couldn't just put a your own headshot in there or something. Like it's almost like he's, I don't know what it is. I'm saying it's almost like he's deaf to it or something, but I can't fathom how there are not people around him saying, you do realize how this is playing here. You do realize that you are standing alone and nobody likes your buddy, and you're going to start wearing this soon.
And it's a good time just to be a little more conscious of what the world is, what's going on in the world, and maybe a little more neutral. But is it also a signature of and a sign of just how afraid he is for his family's health and safety back home? Like, is he thinking, like, if Putin's worried about what Ovechkin or what some of the other Russian athletes are doing on their social media, is that distracting him from what he's trying to do with the war situation and all of that? But is Ovechkin that afraid that if he removes this picture, is that going to cause his family, put them in harm's way, maybe? Is that why he's not doing it? Like, is that how sensitive it is?
If he was to come out right now and say, I disavow any connection I've had in the past to Putin, he is evil and blah, blah, blah. Yes, you know what? His words would carry the kind of weight that would get back to Russia, and his family could be in danger. And so for that reason, I don't really expect, or for whatever demand I can have, demand in my own mind that Ovechkin make that kind of strong statement. Because his family could be in danger. But the photo, you can't change the photo. Mm-hmm. You can't just put your headshot there, and you're not even saying anything. All you're saying is, I'm not standing shoulder to shoulder with this guy. I'm amazed that the...
You could also say it's my publicist that did it or something like that. Is Putin really going to reach out? Is he going to find out about this? I don't know. I just wonder if it's that much on his mind and the fear that he has for his family who is back in his native land, and is he afraid for that? Is he afraid to make any move whatsoever? But, you know, I like what a lot of them have said, a lot of the Russian athletes, and that is just about no war, like no fighting, no whatever. Like, I support, you know, it is my country, and that it is my leader, whatever I feel about that, but no fighting, no war. And some of them have spoken like that, and I do respect that.
I think it's a good thing that some of these athletes have come out and spoken out. I don't know if their situations are the same as far as family or whatever else. I don't know. But I just like how the Washington Capitals, if nothing else, how the Washington mm-hmm. Capitals have not spoken about this. Now, you know, there's a story that says that exactly what you're saying, story online that says he's been advised not to change his photo. Well, look, if Vladimir Putin, with all that's going on, is going to find a photo change on one hockey player's Instagram page as cause to go and hunt down his family, then boy, I don't think he's paying much attention to what's really going on, because his world is crumbling around him right now. By the sounds of it, the rest of the world has basically said, you are a pariah. The war is not going clearly as he intended it to. There's so much other stuff happening. You think that he's really going to lash out if you change an Instagram photo? Really?
We talked about baseball off the top, right? And to use a baseball expression, he's not keeping his eye on the ball, so to speak, if that's really what it is. And that's what I mean is that, what kind of advisors would he have that would go that deep into it, that would find Ovechkin's Instagram and follow it so closely that he changed the picture and took, you know, Putin off it, which we all agree probably he should. And then it gets back to Putin, who then would act on it and then give direction to do something to Ovechkin's family. You have to think that must be so far down on a to-do list or a care list that it shouldn't even be a factor in how Ovechkin could think over here.
Well, consider one other thing. I mean, Vladimir Putin has problems with the world right now, but so far he's been able to maintain power at home. Alex Ovechkin is a national hero. if you go and start rounding up family members and doing whatever you would do, you possibly run the risk of then having your people turn against you. It would be a dangerous play for him to do this. I find it remarkable. And I don't know the whole Alex Ovechkin story of why he's doing this, but boy, it seems we talked yesterday on the show about how, or the day before, I can't remember, how Russian artists are now being banished and not being permitted to perform, especially if they have refused to speak out against Putin. Ballet dancers from the Bolshoi in London, England, and artists in the Metropolitan Opera in New York, they've been told, you cannot perform. We will not, unless you disavow your country and your leader, you're not permitted here. And yet you've got one of the most high profile hockey players and no one saying anything, I guess. I don't know. Anyway, it's a very puzzling one to me. One more thing. Tiger Woods, apparently, did I read today that Tiger Woods was going into the World Golf Hall of Fame? How is Tiger Woods not in there like 10 years ago?
Well, here's the thing I think with him, because I did see that story and it was touching, but I also think, what happened to you're completely done your career and then there's a time frame like some other halls of fame? Like, I kind of thought this is a thing for Tiger Woods that should happen like 10 years from now. This isn't something that should happen now. To me, it's too early. It's too fresh. We wonder if he's still going to come back and play in a tournament. Not maybe at a competitive level where he's going to win, but you know, we hear in the last week or two about LeBron James wants to play in the NBA with his son. Well, don't you think after that event earlier this year that Tiger Woods would love to play in a PGA event with his son? And I think that could happen. So to me, this is just premature. Like, this is a guy, he's in there. He's first ballot whenever it comes to be. But let's just give it some time. You know, like, it's too soon to me. Like, let him be gone for a while from actively playing in the sport. Now, I'm not saying he's been active a lot lately because he picks and chooses even when he's healthy. But this is for like 5 or 10 years down the road, I think. This is way too soon.
The difficulty with this is that golfers never really stop, because they play till they can't play on the PGA Tour and then join the Champions Tour, the Seniors Tour. And so I don't know when you do this. But the issue is, either you do what you're suggesting, where you say, all right, at least you have to have retired from the PGA Tour, or essentially had like a year. Or if that's not the case, well, then why was Tiger Woods not in the Golf Hall of Fame, as I say, 10 years ago? If we're not waiting, he was a Hall of Famer a decade and a half ago.
You know, part of a Hall of Fame event is you get back with the people. Like, when everyone says, when they retire, what do you miss? I miss being around the guys. I miss being around in the locker room. I miss hanging around the gals that were my teammates and that. And to me, I think it would be even, and this might be maybe not lucrative for the Hall of Fame. Maybe they wanted it to be a big story now. But I think he would be more appreciative of the honor 5 or 10 years down the road when his career is done. And when I agree with you, when I'm talking about his career, I'm talking about a PGA career. I'm not talking about on the Senior Tour or anything like that, because he could be a good draw on the Senior Tour, even if he picked his spots there.
Oh, are you kidding? Yeah.
Yeah. You know, like, that would revitalize it. But he would appreciate, I know he would appreciate it more in 5 or 10 years down the road when he's a little more distanced from the day-to-day of it.
Well, I'm trying to look up here and see the one, and this is, it's going to be impossible to do it because it appears that it's not in alphabetical order. Let me just look here, because I'm trying to find out if Phil Mickelson is already into the World Golf Hall of Fame. Somebody listening who's a huge golf fan is probably going, class of 2012. So Phil Mickelson is not that much older than Tiger Woods. He's a little bit older, but he's not that much older than Tiger Woods, and he was in a decade ago.
Yeah, it goes to your theory of, well, then Tiger should have been in before him, maybe. You know, if that was the
case. Yeah. Of course.
So they should have, like, Phil even, he should be in my mind, like, he just won. He won a major. So he should be in like 5 or 7, 10 more years from now, even. you know? And that gives us a chance. Like, everyone, when you think back to players like Michael Jordan, even better now that he was in, you know, in his day in our minds, the way we speak about him. So it's got to be a 5 or 10 year wait period in my mind.
I don't know.
We got to run. We got to run things better. We got to run the Hall of Fames.
We got to. You know what? There's really, honestly, there's not one Hall of Fame right now in the big sports that you look at and go, you're doing this right. And for all different things. I mean, hockey is too secretive. Baseball, it's so complicated now with the drug thing. I don't know how you're supposed to do it. Football lets so many guys in the NFL anyway. So many guys in that it seems crazy sometimes. The CFL, I remember a few years ago when Pinball Clemens had to wait for like 5 years after he was possibly eligible. It's like, why? What's going on? Well, did you forget him? And then this, I don't know.
The one thing that I don't like about Hall of Fames too is you have an expiry date. Like, that's your last year of eligibility to be in a Hall of Fame. To me, that's ridiculous as well.
Yeah, it should be in forever. You can.
Yes.
Yeah. Anyway. All right.
So we can't run a math class. We can't do physics class, but we can run a Hall of Fame.
We can run a Hall of Fame, and we could run Alex Ovechkin's Instagram page too.
We'll talk
about that later. Steve Foxtrot, thanks for doing this today. Appreciate it.
Always a pleasure, Scott. Talk soon.
The Scott Radley Show. Weekday evenings from 6 to 8 on 900 CHML.
The Scott Radley Show podcast is available on Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, and wherever you get your podcasts. I'm Scott Radley. Thanks again for listening, and do not forget to subscribe to this podcast. It is free. You will never miss an episode. And also, be sure you rate us and review us. Whatever you think of us, we'll take it. Thanks for listening.
Hi, it's Shauna, and I might be a bad parent because my kids think french fries are vegetables.
Hey, it's Ryan, and I might be a bad parent because I went out for wings when my wife was in the hospital after giving birth.
Johnny here. I might be a bad parent because in my house, the tooth fairy gives pocket change.
But we're not alone. Len emailed us and said his six-year-old daughter's Tarzan moment going from love seat to lazy boy by curtains made him more proud than any dance recital.
And Andy left his two-year-old at the rink.
All right, guys, I'm sure we're not alone, like Andy's kid.
For stories and confessions like this, make sure you check out our podcast.
It's called Bad Parents, and it's available wherever you get your podcasts.
I left a glove at the rink.